Red Eyes Radio. My name is Henrik Palmgren. Thank you for tuning in. You can, of course, find us online at redeyescreations.com. Go there for much more radio, news, video interviews, films, links, and other resources. And today we have Eolas Kefas with us. He is the author of The Lucid View, and you might also have come across his podcast, Stormy Weather. Eolas has a few websites that you can take a look at right away and follow along here during our program today. His main website, or his blog rather, is simply eolaskefas.blogspot.com. And for his podcast, you can take a look at kefas.podmatic.com. And we will have these links up on Red Eyes Creations, of course, in case you have troubling with the spelling of his name there. But so you can find them more easily, and you take a good look around. There's a lot of material up there for you. And we've invited Eolas today to meander around a few different topics related to the conspiracy movement, the 60s, and the new counterculture movement. We're also going to talk a little bit about the control of the high magicians. We're also going to discuss Eolas' podcast and his decision to end the podcast, and much more. And that will probably give us we will probably go into some interesting avenues here today with Eolas. So thank you very much for coming on the program. It's nice to have you with us.
Oh, no, Henrik. I'm very grateful for the opportunity.
You know, briefly, maybe you can tell us a little bit about yourself, how long you've been involved or interested in these so-called esoteric subjects for some of our listeners that might not be familiar with you or your work, Eolas.
Well, initially I was, you might say, hurtled into the arena of alternate perceptions, sorcery, magic, through disappointment in love. Just to get briefly personal, I think that for many of us, we need some kind of personal impetus to seek alternate ways of looking at life. And I suffered a sort of disappointment in love, and that drove me to an astrologer that I felt would be able to counsel me. His name is Lynn Birkbeck. I interviewed him on Stormy Weather, and it was Lynn who recommended to me very strongly the works of Carlos Castaneda. And I would say that those books opened the floodgates, as it were, to a whole other world of imaginal possibilities. And that was really, that was it. There was no going back from that point on. I read all the books within a very short period of time and began a quest that I've continued to this day, just for the last over 20 years now. So one thing led to another, you might say, discovering the world of sorcery. The reality of sorcery alerted me to the realization that there were many areas of life, of reality, that I'd overlooked. And so I began to look at these areas with a new openness, you might say, and that included UFOs and parapolitics and all the rest.
So when did you decide to start up your blog?
The blog was hard to say now. I guess it was about 4 years ago that I initially started the blog, but there wasn't an awful lot going on there until more recently. It was just a site to, I suppose, publicize my book. And I didn't get heavily into blogging until, I'd say, until the last 6 months or so.
Mm. So maybe we can get into some of these areas that, you know, we had. We could, of course, go into the avenue of talking about your book, but you wanted to go into a few other areas here today, Eolas. And one of these is about the general conception about the, or idea about the conspiracy movement, or the people who are interested in esoteric ideas. And I guess also the dangers that you've mentioned of packaging these ideas as a means to reach a wider audience. Maybe you can elaborate a little bit on that for us and set the backdrop of what you mean when you say that.
Well, it's hard to separate like personal feelings from more general feelings. I guess I'm always suspicious of just generally of ideas that are being propagated widely. And I think I mean, because of blogging and podcasting within the last few months, I just became a lot more actively involved with what I term the alternate perceptions community. And so I began to pay much closer attention to what was going on there. And I just very quickly began to realize that there was these recurring narratives that ran through most, if not all, of the different areas that were being discussed. And that in itself made me a little bit suspicious. I was thinking, I mean, this has become particularly prevalent in the last year or two with all of these movies that have been coming out. There's been Zeitgeist, and there's been The End of America, there's been Wake Up Call. I've got a list of them somewhere here. There's quite a few of them. The Esoteric Agenda. And they all more or less are pushing the same narrative that most, if not all, of your listeners will be familiar with, which is the, you know, the global banking and the 9/11 inside job and the implant, the microchip, the sabotage of our food products. You more than anyone is very, very familiar with this. I call it a narrative because essentially what we do as researchers is we pick out certain elements and we choose to emphasize them because there's so much going on in terms of conspiracy, as in covert control. There's so many different areas that one could look at. And so if we choose to focus on particular strands, let's say, of the agenda and bring them, highlight them and emphasize them, then we create a narrative. We create perhaps the illusion of order where there may be an order, but it's not the order that we're discovering. One way I describe it is like we're joining the dots before we have all of the dots. We discover certain things about manipulations and agendas, and we gather those findings together and we think, okay, that's quite a lot of dots now. Let me try and join them. And so when we join the dots, we create an image, which is what I call a narrative. But the thing is if we've only got, say, 1% of the total amount of dots, or even if we've got 50%, which seems highly unlikely, the image that we draw is going to be a false image. And it may be that those dots or these items, these revelations that we're discovering, they may have actually been placed there deliberately by the by our handlers, let's say, by the hidden controllers, the sorcerers, as I refer to them, precisely so that we emphasize them and then join the dots. And then we end up creating a picture that is not actually true and that was actually placed there deliberately so that we would draw this narrative. So then the question is, are we in fact serving the ends and upholding a narrative that pertains to the very people, the very forces that we claim to be attempting to expose? And that's a question that I had to ask myself.
I think it's a good question that everyone should definitely ask themselves. And speaking of Zeitgeist, by the way, we had an article up here on Red Eyes Creations right now about Mr. Joseph, Peter Joseph, who was behind the movie Zeitgeist, which had this mass meeting, if you will, just the other day or yesterday, I guess it was done. And this will be a little bit offset from when we actually record this program. But for the record, I can say March 16th, this article was published in the New York Times, where it actually is mentioned a little bit about with these meetings, what they're doing, how they're trying to have their ideas about what the future will look like and so forth. But anyway, a little piece of this inside the articles, this basically took up this thing with September 11th. The article says that in the film, the first Zeitgeist film, they elaborated on this idea that September were an inside job perpetrated by a power-hungry government on its witless population. And the article goes on to say a point of view that Mr. Joseph has said he has recently moved away from, which I think is quite interesting. What's your take on that, Ailos?
Well, I don't know enough about it, Henrik. Did it give any more details about why, where he'd moved to and why?
Nope, nothing like that at all. They just moved on in the article, at least. So, and I guess that what you might be alluding to there is that you have this incredible, message, an overarching overview message that is incorporated into Zeitgeist that have gotten a whole lot of people interested in this, but now they're kind of, if you will, then leading it down a different path, it seems like, to me at least.
Well, yeah, I mean, if we allow the possibility that 9/11, just to use this as a very obvious dramatic example, if we allow the possibility that that was all staged, that there was a piece of theatre, what I call Masonic sorcery theatre, in order to alter the consciousness of the collective and to rewire it, reconfigure it, you might say, towards new ends. We also have to consider the possibility that the whole inside job, conspiracy, revelation, that this is all part of the theatre also. That's all part of the plan. It's like we're being led. We're being led through this maze, and we're given the illusion that we're actually choosing which way to go. But actually, as I say, these clues are all being planted. I mean, so much of this stuff is coming from insiders who are supposedly whistleblowers. But how do we know that? You know, 9/11, the nature of 9/11, as with the JFK assassination, the murder of Diana, it's so obvious to those of us who know as soon as it happens that something isn't right. But then there's that awareness that there's going to be a percentage of the population who are going to know in their bones that something isn't right, and so they're going to want to dig deeper. So it makes sense, stands to reason, that they would have already planted a whole bunch of clues that are not necessarily false, but they would be red herrings in the sense that they were planted in order to be discovered, so that we would then, even when we went deeper, we would weave the narrative that was already intended by the Masonic sorcerers as part of their theater.
That's a very interesting perspective. I've been pondering upon a few of these things myself in regards to, let's take Building 7, for instance, something that is so obviously kind of, erroneous such a huge thing in this whole picture that just begs for people to look into it, but also discover that in fact the third building went down that day, for instance. Is that the type of example you're talking about here?
Well, it's certainly related, because it's what I would call it's kind of ties in with the revelation, the method, which is very difficult. So the James Shelby Downer theory or Michael Hoffman, and it's a very esoteric one. It's very difficult to really describe the intricacies of it. But in its most profane sense, it's simply letting us see the strings so that we actually become slowly acclimatized to this kind of sorcery, this kind of control. And so that. You know, you could see that as a basic political end. They let us see what's going on, but in such a staggered way that it doesn't cause people to actually wake up en masse. But it creates a growing split between those who are willing to look at what they see and go deeper, and those who aren't willing. And so it has the opposite effect on them. They glimpse a crack in consensus reality, and it frightens them. It's so bold and it's so right there in their face that they have to paper over that crack no matter what. And so when it's something that huge, you're talking about Building 7, the degree of self-deception, of denial, the degree to which people have to suppress what they actually know in their bodies and their guts is so great that it's kind of what's termed as crazy making. It creates a split between the person's conscious mind and their unconscious mind, because they're seeing with their own eyes that something isn't right. But then they're fed this official line and to their conscious mind, and because they're so desperate to cling to the illusion that things are what they seem, even if it's as superficial and as misguided as we can trust our government, which of course is becoming less and less. Mm. Yeah, there's less and less people who are that deep in denial, although perhaps not. I mean, again, it's but the point I'm making is you have to lie to yourself more and more to believe what you want to believe, because the alternative is to start letting go of everything we believe and everything we think we know. And that, of course, is terrifying to people.
But for those who do ask the questions and do research this stuff and go into deeper into it, I guess you're also saying then that this is also a path that is that we're meant to tread on, so to speak. What would you say is the purpose for that? Will this lead us into just another rabbit hole, or do you think that this has to do with this idea that we briefly have talked about for you and me, Elas, about the kind of the white magicians that are even further up the ladder than the black magicians, or those who are trying to control us, as it were?
Well, I'm not sure that I could posit the idea of white magicians and what their agenda would be, because whatever it would be working through what you term the black magicians. I don't really see it in a sort of dichotomy that way. I think the split is in our own psyche, between our conscious and our unconscious minds. You asked what those of us who are being drawn or led to investigate these matters, what's the purpose of that? Well, I would say that it's known, you know, within the control system, let's say, that there is going to be a percentage of the population who are discerning, who can see through the lies, and so they are naturally going to be drawn to look for the truth. And so it's necessary to kind of prepare a space or prepare a narrative that those individuals will actually naturally be drawn to, so that they don't create their own narrative, that they don't actually get to the real truth, which is a much subtler, finer thing. I mean, one example I've given before is with the UFO, and I think that a mistake, I perceive it as a mistake anyway, are those that research parapolitics and conspiracy and the nuts and bolts angle of you know, what the hidden agenda is, that they want to keep it within the parameters of what we think of as consensus reality. So we have these ideas about the Bilderbergs and the Council of Foreign Relations and revisionist history and all the rest of it. And it's very much still within the framework of what we know of as reality. And then on the other hand, you have sort of the other end of the pole, you have the New Agers who are just totally off the chart and kind of in la-la land. And so where do these two perspectives meet? And it seems to me one of the reasons that I am interested in what David Icke does, even though I don't really respond to his methods, is that he is taking the nuts and bolts parapolitical conspiracy narrative. He's taking it into the imaginal realms where nothing is what it seems. And I think that's the only way we can actually understand what is going on here, is if we are willing to go much deeper down the rabbit hole. So the same is with the UFO. You see, people who investigate the UFO, they end up getting confounded in the end, because the evidence is so overwhelming, but it's so contradictory. And what they're mapping is, if you research the UFO, it's not a single phenomenon. There's no way to actually put it in a single box and say the UFO is this. It has to be, if it's anything at all, it has to be many different things. But the key to understanding the UFO finally is that it interacts with the consciousness of the observer. It is shaped and somehow framed by our perception of it, and yet the UFO at the same time is feeding us this information, which is itself shaping our perception. So you see, you've got this two-way current. There's a phenomenon that we don't know what it is, and then there is our own perception of that phenomenon, which we also don't understand. We don't understand the act of perception and how there is a creative element to it. And so what the UFO is doing is it's guiding us potentially to this gnosis, this experience of self-knowledge, by tricking us, by giving us all of these clues that will lead us to an erroneous conclusion, which is a sort of simulation of the real thing. And then if we're able to actually see that, okay, this isn't what it really is, this is just a simulation, this is an image of what it really is. What it really is something that we can only experience by looking inward, by turning our gaze from the outside world to the inner space, and then we will see that the UFO is us, and then we will become truth. We can't actually experience the truth outside of ourselves. We can only experience it by being it. And so this is what I would apply to the whole thing, the whole game that we're uncovering now, and specifically to the global agenda, the elite, the Masonic sorcerers, all the rest. This is something we can only understand when we actually realize that all the evidence we're collecting is actually being fed to us to trick us into creating an image which isn't the truth, so that we will then see that what we're perceiving is going on outside of ourselves is an inner process, it's an alchemical process, and that there is no us and them.
So is that, do you think, also the ultimate purpose then in that sense? Because I guess either way, if we're involved in something long enough, be it research or being just involved in these topics, researching, trying to grow on a personal, individual level, this is possibly then, if it is true, what you're laying out for us here, that indeed is the purpose as well. Are we going to end up with that realization eventually anyway, right? Or do you think that we'll be sidetracked and lured into an area where we can't, you know, escape from or something like that?
What was the realization that you thought we would be led to?
Well, the idea that you described, that the key here, so to speak, is to look inwardly. And my point to add to that was that that is something that we will eventually do then in any way, if we study this phenomena long enough, or if we're involved in these esoteric subjects matters and study ourselves long enough, we will end up in that area eventually anyway, right?
I suppose. I mean, it's very, this is so labyrinthine that one can be sidetracked almost forever, I think. And I think that's the danger, is that this kind of research and this kind of these fields of knowledge do engender obsession. And so I think it's, yes, you could say that if you persist long enough in any direction, you will end up where you need to end up. All roads lead to infinity, as it were, but that's a very long way around. And I think that we can save ourselves an awful lot of time and trouble and grief if we allow that context from the start, which is, you know, it's a theoretical thing that many people are aware of, which is that the universe, that reality is a reflection of our inner processes. You know, as a theory, people are aware of this, but as a practice, it's very rare. And I think particularly in these fields, that there's something about, if you're discovering this millennia-long global agenda, which is apparently malevolent, which is interfering with and sabotaging, you know, our nervous systems, our consciousness at every conceivable level, which is not just a physical global conspiracy, but a metaphysical cosmic conspiracy, you know, with archons and demons and inorganic beings. It's so vast and labyrinthine. And it's not enough to just make this leap and say, okay, it's all part of the galaxy and it's all working for God. We have to actually map the dark side, if you will. I mean, to my mind, it's not only valid, but essential to do these researches into the control system, but to do it always in an alchemical spirit towards individuation, so that there's never the temptation, or rather one never succumbs to the temptation to point the finger and to project one's darkness outward, or to forget, we can't help doing that, but to forget that we are projecting, that the Illuminati, all of these ideas, they're symbolic, they're metaphoric, and they are they represent the disowned aspects of our own psyche. It's all about the other, isn't it? Whether it's the alien abduction, or whether it's Masonic sorcerers, or whether it's global elite, or whatever it is, these are all aspects of the other. So they are part. I mean, my attempt in understanding these things is to always come back to the idea. And I would say even it's an energetic fact, it's a reality, that we are one species, that we are a single organism, which is Earth stroke humanity. Humanity may exist above and beyond the Earth. That may be part of our evolution or our destiny. But right now, humanity is a component in the greater consciousness of the Earth. So we're a single organism. So everything that is happening on the Earth, all of these agendas, these are playing out within the morphogenetic field, the psyche of the species. And that seems to be the only way, the only context that really is going to make true sense of what is happening here, you know, that we're all doing this together. There's only one of us.
So is this a critique against the current method of the conspiracy movement? Is that right?
Well, I don't. I don't feel too comfortable critiquing, as in, because then I might be pointing the finger myself. So far as I would criticize, then I would hope it would be constructive criticism,
mm-hmm.
as giving, you know, just giving my take on it. But it is first and foremost, it's personal, isn't it? Because, you know, I set out. I wrote Lucid View started it. God knows, back in 97 or something. So it took 10 years almost to get it published. And no, it was before that. I started in 94 or so. So anyway, it was a long journey writing the book, getting it published, and then the blog, and then the podcast. So this journey has kind of reached this culmination point within the last few weeks where I have... really seen this evolution of my own psyche through not just exploring these ideas, but disseminating them, sharing them. This to me was a very transformative process, and that was why I set about to do the podcast in the first place, was so that I could discover new things about myself and find new perspectives, new ways of looking at what I know, you know, what I believe, I should say. And that to me was always my intent, Henrik, behind the podcast was a self-exploration. But what I noticed happening in the last few weeks, well, rather, I noticed it all along, because it, you know, within 6 months, Stormy Weather went from a little podcast that no one had heard of, like 500 downloads a month, to 8,000 downloads a month. And that's in a 6 month period. So it was expanding very rapidly, and I was getting a lot of feedback, and there was this sense, there was a very exciting, very gratifying sense of being part of something. And it gave me pause, because I became aware that I was getting more and more into the numbers. I was getting more and more into this, where, you know, this is getting bigger, this is leading to this, and the whole idea of kind of marketing and packaging and branding, just to... make it this streamlined enterprise that would be head to these wonderful stratospheres, you know, and be communicating to more and more people. And I just suddenly had to stop and question that, you know, what is my motive there? Because, you know, commercial success or solvency, what have you, is all very well, but it doesn't mix too well with the kind of work that I was doing, which was very abstract and very esoteric. And so to try and mix that with making a living, I don't think it's really possible without some sort of compromise. So I had to question that, like, okay, is this really, you know, do I want to incorporate the need for financial stability with what I'm doing here, and therefore kind of lose a little bit of just doing it for the hell of it? There was that question, and that really the answer was, well, wait a minute, no, I don't think that's a very wise move, because what I see that I'm doing here, as I said, is a self-transformative process, and it can't be directed outward. So that was that. And then the other question was, well, yes, but reaching more people is valid, isn't it? You need to reach more people, you want to spread the word, etc. And that, if I looked at that closely, I also had to realize that that wasn't right, that wasn't true, because that's actually not what I feel. I don't feel that it is my job or anybody's job to wake up the masses. That, I think, is a very mistaken idea. First of all, because it presumes that we or whoever's doing the awakening is already awake, and I don't presume that for a minute. I know full well that I'm not awake. I might be a little more lucid in my dreaming than others. I might have a sense that, wait a minute, this is a dream, isn't it? But that doesn't mean I'm awake. See what I mean?
Mm. So, I mean, in that sense, just because your podcast was growing, did you feel that you had to repackage it and change the format just because of it? Or did you rather see that you had an opportunity there and that was what led you in the wrong path? Is that right?
Well, it was. I think it was simply a matter of this has been a success, and that is enough. Why try and take it to the next level? I don't want to be the next David Icke. I don't want to have a following, and I don't want to be propagating ideas or narratives for people to follow. You see, I was just doing a self-exploration process and invited others to join in, but inevitably, it became less and less about the message and more about the messenger. That it's an inevitable process. If one turns what one does into a product, then one is branding, one is packaging, one is marketing. And
you didn't want to do that.
As I say, no. I felt that it would be untrue to the spirit of the enterprise. Finally, that I would be deceiving people without meaning to. The whole cult of personality thing, it's a great paradox, because I was talking a lot about how we don't know what's what, and I don't know what's what, and I was trying to be absolutely as open as possible, and yet that in itself kind of, I think, attracted people, and that gave them the idea that maybe I knew what I was talking about because I was claiming not to know what I was talking about. You know what I mean?
Hmm. Yeah, well, it becomes a bit weird. To me, right off the bat, it feels like also that if we look at human history, this is, you know, we have been involved in commerce, trading services against another service. There's a whole tradition, if you will, that even that, I think, and feel is part of our genetic, you know, and even our unconscious forces that are driving us, that we have handled things in a certain way for a certain period of time, and we can't just erase that overnight and expect that everything should be different the other day. I think it's a slow process, and I think it's a good initial step to begin to think of it that way, obviously, to begin to change things. But it sounds maybe that it's a bit too much to change everything overnight. You know what I mean?
Sure. Well, yeah, but we can only change ourselves in the end, anyway.
Yes.
And I mean, the question is how much does it benefit our own transformation to sort of enter in? It's like kind of, you know, joining the thing to beat them, or, you know, trying to change the system from within. That whole thing of being a virus. Well, we're going to be changed by that process. If we try and streamline and package what we're doing in a way to reach people because we think that that's a worthy goal, which it may well be, we are going to be compromised. It's entirely inevitable, because, as you say, this, I mean, we have hundreds of years of this tradition. It's like a morphogenetic field, which we're hardwired to want success, to want recognition, to want fame, to want a following, to want to be respected, and this, you know, it's in the society, but it's also in us as individuals, our imprinting as children. We didn't get the affection or the attention we needed as children. We're compensating for that in the stuff we do as adults. And so there's all of these different motives, you know, bubbling under the surface, and so for me to kid myself, or for any of us to kid ourselves, that we're doing this because it's a service, you know, to disseminate information, to wake up people, I think that's quite dangerous.
Why?
As I say, well, because again, we're looking outward. It may be that it is good for our process to play that role, but only if we're aware that it's just a role. You see what I mean? Rather than if we actually believe that we're doing something, because we don't actually really know, do we? What's going on? At least that's my understanding. I mean, that's what I've had to accept, that when you go down the rabbit hole, you just keep on going. We really don't know how deep the rabbit hole goes at this point. So all we know right off the bat, as soon as you get in the rabbit hole, is that nothing is what it seems. But then this compulsion of the intellect to, even though it knows that, just come out, create a new paradigm where, okay, well, now it is what it seems. Now it's a global agenda. Now it's the Illuminati. Now it's galactic consciousness. Now it's, you know, Armageddon. All we're doing is creating another paradigm using the components of the old one, which we reshuffled. We haven't actually, and so we're actually halting our process or progress down the rabbit hole. It's like we're trying to get back out, in a sense, like Ikey with his reptilians. You know, he's discovered something that is imaginal, which is beyond this paradigm, and then he drags it screaming into this paradigm and says, look, reptilian blood drinking aliens. You know, not to turn Ikey into a whipping boy here. We all do it. We just have to frame what we discover within the context of what we already know. And to me, that is it is at best counterproductive, and at worst it's fatal, because it will, one possible and very likely result is that it allows us to trick ourselves into thinking we found it, that we're tuning in to it. This emergence that we all feel that's happening in the world now, this emergence of this greater consciousness, I call it galactic consciousness, the imaginal realms, fairyland, you know, alien intelligence. There's all these different ways of perceiving it, but none of them are actually it. When we're actually in it, we can't speak about it. We can't even think about it. And so what is it that we are describing here? We sense an emergence, and so then we want to define it, and then we want to identify with it, and then we want to say, okay, we're this emergence, like Barack Obama with his, we are the ones we've been waiting for. I feel that is really not the case. I think that we are just, let's kind of get Nietzschean, you know, man is a bridge. We're a bridge from one kind of consciousness to another, but we're not it. We're like the eggs that need to be cracked, and yet we're already talking about the omelette, like we know what it is, and like we are this emerging thing. And that I'm kind of starting to rant here, but it really did strike me that I was unconsciously playing this role that I. And I realized that so many others in the community are doing it too. They're propagating ideas, and we're forming this new counterculture through the internet, particularly. And it is a time for that. I don't know if you know astrologically. I mean, the '60s it was a Uranus-Pluto opposition, and that was the major astrological impetus behind the '60s. And we're in the same kind of opposition of planets now. I forget if it's a square. I think it's a square now of Uranus-Pluto, which is probably tougher.
Yes.
But there's also many other planetary alignments. And so what we're seeing now is the next cycle after the '60s, you know, the next cycle up in the spiral, much, much bigger, much, much more transformative. And Uranus-Pluto is all about the awakening of the shadow and the awakening to the shadow.
Yes.
You know, which is it? If we awaken to the shadow within ourselves, then we are transformed. If it's an awakening of the shadow, it's an external process, then we are annihilated, chances are, like in World War II, we have that kind of thing. Or to bring it back to the '60s, we had Manson as the disowned shadow of the counterculture. Because the hippies weren't able to awaken to the shadow within themselves, there was an awakening of the shadow in the external world, and the hippie became Charles Manson, which was probably a psyop, was probably a government-controlled operation in itself, Charles Manson. But then I think so was the '60s, and this is something I'd be interested to talk to you about also is... This idea that the '60s itself.
I just want to interject and add something to what you said, because I think that you have a good point, and I think that what it's describing is the initial awareness of that, and begin to obviously change your own path if you feel that you're not comfortable with it. At the same time, I want to add from my personal point of view that I feel that we're in a process right now. It's like looking at someone who's taking, well, think about the idea of baby steps, right? It's like we're kicking the legs off, you know, under a baby because we don't consider it proper walking in a way, but we need to consider that, okay, well, we need to give it a little bit of time as well. We are very, very, you know, we're just begun to look into some of these more esoteric subjects, many of us at least, in that sense, and on a mass scale. It might be that more is coming along or less is. I'm not sure about the demographics there. To me, it feels like there is a little bit of a quote-unquote awakening going on in that sense. But I also feel that it's up to the receiver of the information and not as much as the disseminator of the information, because it's the consumer of the information, so to speak, must move on in the right time and not sit around and wait for someone else to kind of take their hand and lead them down the rabbit hole. So I understand what you're saying, yet at the same time, I don't want to take away the responsibility, if you will, from the one who is at the receiving end of all of this, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, well, absolutely. But I mean, the tendency is of us all, isn't it, is to want to be led down the rabbit hole. We look for leaders.
And that's the danger.
For teachers, for gurus. And that is the danger, because we don't have to do anything. And as I say, I was actively conscious of avoiding that trap myself in what I did, but it didn't matter, because then that made people kind of want to follow me even more.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's just part of human nature. And yeah, I understand your metaphor with the baby, and it's a good one. And really, yes, this is why I said that I was wary of criticizing others, because I don't know what is right or good for others to do. I can only speak of my own sort of intuitive or gut feeling about this whole era. And I think, you know, if I was becoming a bit overwrought about it, I think it's because of a sense of how easy it is for us to be tricked and to miss the boat, because of how it's happened before.
Of course,
what
absolutely.
We've seen with the 60s.
Yeah.
We can even get paranoid about it, if you like, and consider the possibility, I would say the inevitability, that what I term the alternate perceptions community, which we're both active players, has going to have been co-opted from the very start, just as the 60s was. You know, in the 60s, I don't know an awful lot in terms of, you know, names and dates and all the rest of it. Dave McGowan has done a lot of good work on this, and, you know, mapping the ways in which many of the bands and musical movements and all the rest of it seem to actually be part of a psyop, seem to have an intelligence fingerprints on them.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
But I would say, you know, just to use a very basic example, that the hippie, the whole idea of the hippie, that the word, the dress, the language, all of these ideas, I think, were created by intelligence when they became aware that something was happening, mm-hmm. something was emerging. There was this new emergence of consciousness in the youth, and that it was going to become organized, it was going to become socially active, and it was going to have huge repercussions on the status quo. And so they had to act very quickly and very imaginatively when they, and perhaps shouldn't talk about intelligence communities, because this probably goes to much higher or deeper levels in terms of sorcerers and who knows what all is behind the scenes. But the idea that I want to suggest is that the individuals of the counterculture were probably, you know, 80% of them were genuine people who were awakening to something and really wanted to express it, but that they were somehow corralled into a movement that they didn't create, and they were given the illusion that they had created this movement,
right,
without suspecting that it had actually been laid down, the tracks had been laid down for them, in a very subtle manner, so that this new awakening energy could be redirected down channels that were already under control.
Yes.
You see what I mean?
Absolutely.
So this minimized the amount of damage that was done. And so then you've got Timothy Leary as CIA, and you've got all this LSD being brought in by the CIA, and all these different musical groups, the Beatles, and all part of this collective programming, which, okay, the 60s was a powerful thing, and you know, I like a lot of these bands myself. I'm not going to just say, oh, well, they were all, it was all just a psyop and it was all corrupt. Sure. Clearly that's not the case, but I think that it was contained in a way that it would actually eventually burn out in the way that it did, and even become this distorted image of what it was intended to be,
mm-hmm.
With Charles Manson being, as it were, the sort of final nail in the coffin of the counterculture.
Mm.
And so, you know, how much more is this going to be the case now with what's happening now with the internet making it possible for these individuals, for ourselves, to really network, to really organize, to really start propagating memes that could actually bring about the transformation of the species, bring about a whole new reality. The potential is mind-boggling, and it is happening anyway. It's not down to a few individuals, thank God. That, I guess that's my point, is that what is happening now is happening energetically. It's a movement of spirit. And so it will, of course, manifest through individuals, and it will use us or them or whoever to manifest, to forge a new reality. But it's not dependent upon us, really. I mean, we're just along for the ride, you might say. That's how I see it, that what is happening now is so far beyond any kind of human control or human design or will or agenda,
mm-hmm.
that the sooner that we accept that and surrender to it and realize that we're not it, you know, we're not pushing this new awakening, we're simply trying to ride a wave.
You know, I'm thinking also about the Green Movement, for instance, about the same thing there. Many people might think that this has been a grassroots initiative, and this has come from the bottom and up, so to speak. But and that might have been a case at the beginning, though. But then again, we after a short period of time, you see that the entire movement has been hijacked. The elite rulers recognize that, oh, there is energy here. There is good intent, so to speak. There is a lot of people who are engaged and involved. Let's bring more people on. Let's use this energy. Let us ride on this wave, and then we now can propel, you know, the global agenda or global politics under the guise of this rising and kind of well-meaning, if you will, green revolution, if you will, that is kind of going on. And I see the same thing mirrored there, actually.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the environmental movement is a perfect example, I think, of that. Yeah, because it's very much a distraction, I think, the environmental thing, once again. It's not really it. I think it's a side effect of something else that's happening again within the psyche. I don't know. I mean, what is a control system? What is it afraid of? And, you know, what is it most determined to suppress in us?
Mm.
I would say it's self-knowledge, gnosis, an awareness of ourselves, of our potential, of our divine nature, and of our ability, our natural ability to know the truth, to know, you know, just to know. And because, of course, it's impossible to manipulate and control those who have gnosis. And you see, sleepers, you know, magical beings who are put asleep, put under a spell, are a source of food, a source of energy. And this is what we're dealing with here on the planet, in my opinion, in my experience, is that we are basically being farmed, our consciousness, our emotions, our energy, our life force is being farmed. And so the whole global, environmental, political everything that's going on, all of that is simply a distraction to this basic energetic reality, which is that we've been put under a spell, a reality, a false reality, a false narrative that's been woven out of the stuff of our own consciousness, the stuff of our dreams, so that we will stay asleep in our pods and provide this constant food source to whatever it is that's feeding on us. I mean, this is a very sticky, tricky air, isn't it? But I know that you're familiar with it because you've had guests on your show who've talked about it.
What do you think, Alice? Do you want to continue talking more about this in our member section? Do you have time for us?
Absolutely, yeah. Is that an hour already?
Yeah, we're up towards 50 minutes here, and I think that this will be a good point for you to mention a few of your websites, mention your books so people can get a copy if they're interested in finding more of your work and so forth.
Okay, well, the websites, you've given them out, Podomatic, kfus.podomatic.com and aoskfus.com will actually take you to the blog. They are basically going to be unattended from now on. I mean, I'm just winding up my affairs on the internet, so I've turned these sites exquisite corpses for those who are curious to look at the remains of this ministry that I built and maintained for a very brief time. I'm not sure how long it'll be up, but there's 30 podcasts. The last one is going up this week, and I will leave them up for a while for people to listen to.
Okay.
And as for my,
go ahead.
Yeah, my book was Lucid View, Investigations into Occultism, Ufology, and Paranoid Awareness.
And we will have these links up on redhousecreations.com, so you can find them more easily, and of course take a look at this. And I'm going to ask you, Elas, a little bit more here in the next segment about what will become of the sites, what he will do in the meantime, I guess, here, choose to do, spend his time on, rather than sitting around on the web trying to convince other people of what's right and what's wrong and what's not and what is and so forth. But we're going to take a little break here. Thank you for joining us here in the first segment, ALS. We're going to listen to some music, and we'll be right back. Thank you for tuning in to our first part with Elas Kefas. We're going to continue our interesting conversation in our member section, and we'll get into the collective psyche. We're going to talk about the power of love, the building of the light body. We'll also talk about so-called problems and reincarnation, refining consciousness, science and technology, the cloning of mummies, orphans, demons, reality as a computer game, the placebo effect, the uncertainty of reality, and much more. If you want to tune in and aren't yet a member, go to our website, redeyescreations.com. Click on subscribe to sign up, get instant access, and tune in. We will talk more after this pause. Everybody wants to be the DJ.